The Sunstone Foundation presents Alcohol, Sex, and Grooming at Brigham Young University, 1875-1985. Recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Might as well get going as quick as possible. My name is Bill Silcock. I'm the news director of Channel 11 and Classical 88 at KBYU. I came there last October, and before that I produced the 10 o'clock news for Channel 4. I was asked by some of the Sunstone management to chair this panel, and I'm delighted to hear more about a university that I love and to understand a little bit more about its historical background. We have for our topic this afternoon alcohol, sex, and grooming at Brigham Young University. Our paper has been written by Ron Prittis, and the comment will come from Camille Williams. Ron is the business manager of Signature Books and is about to publish new history on Brigham Young University. He'll tell you more about that. Camille teaches at the Y and got her bachelor's and master's at the Y. She teaches in the English and Humanities department, and she's a specialist in stylistics and in the language of Shakespeare. Finally, as an introduction, let me just pull one quote that I found that I like that talks about a university. When I was looking to go back to graduate school and was receiving all of the literature and propaganda from the different schools around the country, Columbia in Missouri, one of the best journalism schools, sent me a little brochure with a beautiful picture of their building and a quote from John Mansfield on the front. And this quote talks about universities. Let me share that with you. There are few earthly things more splendid than a university. In these days of broken frontiers and collapsing values, when the dams are down and the floods are making misery, when everything looks somewhat grim and every ancient foothold has become something of a quagmire, wherever a university stands and shines. Wherever it exists, the free minds of men, urged on to full and fair inquiry, may still bring some wisdom into human affairs. And I'd like to now introduce Ron Prittis. Ron?
A common misconception about Brigham Young University is that it has always been a place of strictly supervised moral behavior, much like an Eastern military school. Another misconception is that BYU students have been unwavering examples of abstinence from alcohol and premarital sex and of immunity from bizarre fashion trends, when in reality the rules governing off-campus behavior and compliance to those rules have varied according to the predispositions of successive BYU presidents, the changing mood of the student body, and other related factors. Brigham Young University was founded in 1875 when Brigham Young endowed the struggling Timpanogos branch of the University of Deseret and renamed it Brigham Young Academy. Although the academy offered a few college-level classes, most courses were elementary or high school level, and the average age of the student body was only 14 years. Academy Principal Carl Mazur's teaching experience was limited to 7 years at three different elementary schools in Austria and Saxony, where he had lived before immigrating to Utah. Austria and Saxony, as elsewhere in continental Europe in the 18th and 19th centuries, had not developed the British invention of housing students in dormitories or of supervising moral behavior. Perhaps as a result, Mazur was initially reluctant to supervise students' after-school behavior, despite their youth and the fact that many of them were away from home for the first time. After serving 3 years at BYA, however, Mazur admitted that the students behaved so badly off campus that some means would have to be devised to assure their moral safety. He therefore created a house check program called the Domestic Organization, which provided that students would be visited in their residences at stated intervals by faculty representatives who would instruct them in appropriate behavior as outlined by Mazur. Defending his domestic organization in 1880, Mazur stated, "Some may think it none of my business where they are or what they do when out of school, but that is the law of the academy, and if they wish it to be none of my business, all they have to do is leave." Domestic organization rules were drafted forbidding the use of strong drinks and vulgar language and banning participation in any kind of unruly or obscene behavior. A curfew was established, and undergraduates were especially advised to avoid loitering near the local skating rink and train station. Although regulations appeared to be fairly restrictive, pupils soon discovered that the faculty assigned to visit their boarding rooms were content to counsel and advise them and were not interested in espionage, as the students called it. In fact, Mazur promised students that they would still be on their honor to confirm or deny accusations made against them, and that any student who wanted to make himself smart by disobeying the rules without being found out was perfectly welcome to all the honor and glory resulting from such a course. Whenever a student confessed to a violation of domestic organization rules, Mazur would send a note to the student's parents informing them of infractions and recommending disciplinary action. The student was placed under house arrest with the cooperation of the student's landlord. But according to one faculty member, house arrest was too formal and did little to retard the natural exuberance and instincts of normal young men who simply sneaked out of back windows. The student newspaper joked that whereas the faculty complained that they can't find the boys at home, the young ladies can probably tell where they spend their time. Mazur was replaced as principal in 1892 by Benjamin Clough, Jr. Clough was the first member of the faculty to hold a college degree, which he received from the University of Michigan. He was a proponent of the progressive educational theories of John Dewey. His appointment was protested by several local citizens who referred to him as one of those Eastern intellectuals who would contaminate the student body with foreign ideas. Soon after his arrival, he reorganized the domestic organization so that the students were assigned to visit fellow students, relieving the faculty of this largely unwanted chore. The responsibility for determining and enforcing rules was also transferred to students. The school catalog explained that this was done in order to develop the power of self-government in the students. Clough added that the greatest liberty possible is allowed the students until by some overt act they demonstrate that they are not able to use that liberty with wisdom and discretion. The student body gradually eliminated specific rules, retaining only a provision that those who were reckless or indiscreet would be liable to be placed under special restrictions and regulations. Under Clough's replacement, George Brimhall, the university returned to a policy of strict regimentation and administrative surveillance of morals. Among Utah Valley residents, Brimhall was a popular choice as president. He had taught elementary school in nearby Spanish Fork, and had served as superintendent of Utah County Schools. During his 17-year administration, he emphasized religious instruction and teacher training over otherwise more normal academic courses. Soon after his appointment, he claimed the right to announce additions to the rules at any time. He prohibited attendance at pool halls and bowling alleys and even ruled on such issues as gum chewing. Brimhall asked theology teachers to make inquiries into student behavior and to hand in to the presidency of the school a list of students violating the regulations. The domestic organization was transformed into a faculty-supervised student court in which students were tried by their peers for using profanity, smoking, consuming intoxicants, and attending places of questionable repute. Those found guilty were subject to dismissal from school. A faculty-student board of control, which was created to oversee student government, formed what it called a student police force, and organized a staff of student disciplinarians to monitor the halls for students attempting to evade classes. When Brimhall was succeeded by Franklin Harris in 1921, the administration of discipline at BYU returned to the earlier, more lenient policies established by Clough. Harris was the first BYU president to hold a PhD, which he received from Cornell. He was also the first monogamous BYU president and the first president to sport neither a beard nor a mustache. And I point out again, this was 1921 when he was appointed. Harris assured students that during his tenure there would be no particular rules to live up to except to be men and women in the real sense. He reported the following year that the university took pride in being an institution practically without rules, adding, "We simply expect every student to be a gentleman or a lady, and we leave largely to each individual the responsibility for doing this as best he or she can." In 1925, Harris authorized a curfew and a prohibition against men and women living in the same house or building. This was done at the suggestion of the Dean of Women, Ethel Butt. But with these two exceptions, he held to his promise of keeping rules to a minimum and of leaving their enforcement to students. In the early 1940s, for example, Army Specialized Training Program and Civilian Pilot Training Program cadets were quartered on campus, and there was drinking and smoking among the cadets even in campus buildings. Some undergraduates took advantage of this situation and began openly drinking alcohol and smoking freely all over town, according to the school newspaper. Harris dismissed this as simply an inevitable result of what he called war hysteria. But his successor in 1945, Howard MacDonald, was less tolerant. MacDonald came to the university with a nearly completed doctorate in education from the University of California, Berkeley, and had previously worked as a high school physical education instructor, a high school administrator, an instructor at Utah State Agricultural College, and as superintendent of the Salt Lake City School District. Soon after his arrival, he warned students that he was giving them 3 months to clear up their bad habits, after which he would begin suspending those who drank alcohol and smoked tobacco either on or off campus. Following the president's notice, the campus newspaper was filled with letters to the editor defending the smokers and drinkers, especially the veterans who had presumably acquired these habits during the war. One irate student, George Baliff, called MacDonald's position belligerent and unchristian. But however reluctantly students received MacDonald's position, strict conformity to word of wisdom prohibitions thereafter became a permanent hallmark of BYU, as is of course well known. Regardless of the approach taken by BYU presidents prior to MacDonald's administration, the number of students indulging in alcohol and tobacco seems to have remained relatively stable prior, of course, to MacDonald's administration. The changing interpretation of the word of wisdom by church members in the early 1930s from a call for moderation to a command for abstinence seems to have helped make MacDonald's campaign successful. For example, in the early 1900s, Brimhall reported that at least 40% of the students enrolled in the school's missionary preparation class had such bad habits as using tobacco, intoxicants, and visiting saloons. The 1920 school yearbook reported that the boys passed a resolution that they'll never use tobacco or swear again, but you know where good resolutions go, end of quote. In the following year, in filling out a theology class questionnaire, students admitted to regularly indulging in strong drink, provoking a faculty investigation to see where the students were obtaining the alcohol. This was, of course, during Prohibition years. Meanwhile, an advertisement in the school newspaper announced that a new shipment of fermented drinks was available from the SBS, which was the Clandestine Student Bootleg Society. When a student reporter provided some details about the distribution of alcohol to students in the school newspaper and then refused to provide administrators with the names of those involved, the reporter was temporarily suspended from school. This was Sam Taylor, by the way. In 1929, an editorial in the campus newspaper explained that there was a fair proportion of the student body who used liquor to a greater or lesser degree. In fact, the editorial continued, "There are few among us who could almost be branded as old soaks." In the mid-1930s, Harold Christensen, then a senior in sociology, surveyed BYU student attitudes and behavior and found that 37% were not opposed to drinking beer and that 7% were not opposed to alcoholic intoxication. Although he asked in this survey about attitudes and not behavior, he found in other areas of the survey that behavior was consistently less conservative than beliefs. 20 years later, a study conducted by another researcher reported that 30% of the student body used alcohol, 19% occasionally got drunk, and 22% used tobacco. I might mention that there were a number of similar surveys that were taken during this period. Adam S. Bennion, for instance, the superintendent of church schools, found that a third of all church youth used tobacco or alcohol or coffee. And there were also master's theses at BYU which found similar results during this period. The interesting thing, though, is that in 1973, when Christensen readministered his 1935 survey with assistance from BYU sociologist Kenneth Cannon, he found that acceptance of beer consumption had dropped to only 3%, and that only 1% of all students approved of alcoholic intoxication. In a related area, it was not until 1968 that coffee and tea were officially prohibited from campus. A 1917 BYU German Club luncheon was reported in the school newspaper to have included weenie sandwiches, dill pickles, cake, and coffee, just matter-of-factly. And throughout the 1920s and 1930s, students writing for the school newspaper frequently referred to, again, in a matter-of-fact way, to having a morning cup of coffee as a part of their daily routine. Students later told of staying alert for tests by drinking strong black coffee and by taking caffeine-laced wakies, which would be comparable to no-dose. But references in the 1940s and 1950s to coffee and tea were few and far between, indicating that it was probably not administrative action which affected the student body so much as their own changing religious convictions. Besides alcohol use, Christensen's and Cannon's longitudinal study revealed a significant decline in acceptance of premarital sex over the nearly 40 years surveyed. In 1935, Christensen found that 73% of the students approved of what was called premarital necking, 14% approved of premarital petting, and 7% could find nothing objectionable about premarital intercourse. A 1954 study commissioned by school administrators similarly found that as many as 14% of BYU students had engaged in premarital intercourse. This was reported in a formal presentation during a faculty workshop which focused on the honor code. Yet by 1973, according to Christensen and Cannon, only 48% of the student body approved of necking, 4% only approved of petting, and only 1% condoned premarital intercourse. A longitudinal study conducted from 1950 to 1972 by BYU sociologist Wilford Smith found a similar decrease in the incidence of premarital intercourse among students from approximately 8% in 1950 to less than 4% 20 years later. Heavy petting decreased from 40% to 23%. Judging from the content of campus publications, early BYU undergraduates were also less inhibited about public discussion of sexuality than later generations. In 1930, for example, a campus reporter claimed that BYU men preferred coeds who petted for only 5 minutes at a stretch. In 1936, a columnist suggested that an appropriate theme for the junior prom would be a date in the hand is worth two in the bush. The women's dormitory, Amanda Knight Hall, was known among students as a man, a night hall. And in 1929, one student expressed his appreciation for what he had learned at BYU, unintentionally commenting on the apparent ambivalence existing among early students regarding sexual behavior, when he wrote that at BYU he had learned to, quote, live within the bounds of moral honesty and yet live shorn of the suffocating cloaks of false modesty and pretenses. I have fun with the girls, he said, love them, pet them, kiss them. They have the same fun with me. But, he wrote, I remember they are somebody's sisters. I will have no double standard. It is also significant that the early administrative statements regarding sexual behavior were less frequent and less direct than recent admonitions, mirroring a similar trend in church addresses and literature, which undoubtedly affected student attitudes to some degree. President Clough discreetly warned coeds not to become unduly familiar with their gentlemen friends, and that's as far as he would go in discussing sexuality. President Harris, speaking to students 38 years later, reported that he allowed his children to attend movies because they taught one how to kiss. Such broad-mindedness gradually gave way during the 1960s and 1970s to such warnings as that of a visiting general authority in 1962 that kissing before marriage is like having a friend lick the butter off a sandwich for you. BYU President Ernest Wilkinson called public expressions of affection sickening and warned that certain crimes and offenses against offensive conduct, such as premarital sexual behavior, would bring immediate suspension from the university. Wilkinson, a successful Washington, D.C. lawyer before being named president of BYU in 1951, had grown up in Ogden, Utah, near the city's red light district, and he had had what he called a rough adolescence, associating with neighborhood toughs, as he called them. Acquaintances remember that while at BYU, his background was often reflected in his sometimes what they called crude mannerisms and his penchant for off-color jokes. In a sense, his insistence on rigorous moral standards can be seen as an attempt to provide for students the kind of environment he had not known as a youth. 2 years before Wilkinson assumed the BYU presidency, students obtained what they considered a major concession from school officials when they received permission to establish a student honor code. Students were made responsible for enforcing rules against cheating and the use of alcohol and tobacco, and for determining punishments in a student court without administrative intervention. In fact, administrators were barred from court sessions. Without going into the details of the honor system, it proved to be enormously successful. As just one example, a study conducted by a BYU sociologist over a six-year period found that cheating decreased 63% as a result of the system. I might just mention how that was done. This was Ray Canning. He would conduct a test. The next time the class met, he would pass the test out to the students, giving the impression he hadn't had time to grade the test. and then monitor the amount of blanks filled in afterwards, answers changed, and that kind of thing. Not addressed in the honor code was sexual behavior, which was a great concern to President Wilkinson, who lobbied heavily to have students revise the honor code to make it more comprehensive. Wilkinson offered to rewrite the code himself, although students declined the offer. Meanwhile, Wilkinson appointed two successful faculty committees to address what he called the masturbation problem, and in 1957 ordered a pamphlet printed entitled Latter-day Saint Standards at Brigham Young University, outlining standards he felt the Honor Code had neglected, including an injunction against sexual relations outside the marriage covenant, which Wilkinson noted was regarded by the Lord as a sin second only to murder in seriousness. In 1967, Wilkinson arranged to have an amended honor code published in the school catalog without announcing the changes to students, faculty, or to any but a few trusted administrators. The revised code eliminated student courts and added the standards Wilkinson had not been able to persuade students to adopt. So secret was the work on the new document that the admissions office continued to mail copies of the old honor code to students applying for admission, unaware that a change had been made. To add to the confusion, another version of the honor code appeared in the 1967 faculty handbook. The administration is trying to put something over on the student body, editors of the student newspaper commented in comparing the three documents. The handbook version of the honor code claimed jurisdiction over faculty as well as students, although faculty resisted submission in what was described as a heated, emotional faculty meeting. The most striking statement in the faculty version of the honor code was the incomplete sentence, "The church does not approve of any form of," and then there was a blank. Wilkinson had intended to have the words "artificial birth control" appear in the space left blank. But when he was unable at the last minute to secure the first presidency's endorsement for this statement, he called BYU press officials and told them to remove "artificial birth control" from the honor code, which they did. To resolve the confusion over the code, the dean of students, with Wilkinson's acquiescence, organized a committee of five administrators and six students in early 1968 to draft an altogether new document. The resulting code of student conduct outlined the university's expectations of students without indicating how alterations might be made in the future or implying a need for student body ratification and leaving discipline to administrators by default. Behavior forbidden by the code included violations of what was termed the high moral standards of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, including the law of chastity, end quote, with specific mention of disorderly, lewd, indecent, obscene, or otherwise illegal or immoral conduct, which were, however, not defined. The use of drugs, tea, coffee, alcoholic beverages, and tobacco were also expressly forbidden. A number of rules were intentionally written to be vague enough to cover unforeseen eventualities. Significantly, the president of the university was given authority to interpret the code. Wilkinson was given the authority to, in this case, to interpret the code. Concurrent with Wilkinson's campaign to make the honor code more comprehensive was a less successful move to establish uniformity in dress and grooming. Although Wilkinson was not the first BYU administrator to exhibit concern over fashions and trends in grooming, he was the first to suggest specific regulations regarding dress and grooming. In 1937, for example, President Harris had written to former superintendent of church schools Horace Cummings, "I know there is a good deal of discussion about the effect of length of skirts and length of sleeves, etc., on modesty and morality, but I myself am somewhat baffled to know just what the relationship is." Harris added that he did like to see modesty, however, whatever that may be. A greater concern for Harris than the amount of skin left exposed by certain kinds of clothing was the alienation of poorer students by clothing flaunted by those who could afford popular styles. "We want to be democratic in our dress," Harris told undergraduates. He encouraged the wearing of class uniforms, which students had adopted 5 years earlier in 1916, consisting of white shirts and various shades of corduroy pants for the men and white cuffs and collars for women. Each year, students introduced minor changes to these uniforms, but the basics persisted. Standardized dress existed in some form until the end of Harris's term as president. The earliest Brigham Young Academy students wore beards when able. If a young man shaved, it was a sign of disregard for tradition and an indication of, quote, bad company, end quote. John Swenson, who later joined the sociology department, was thoroughly grilled about his clean-shaven face during an interview for a teaching position at a local school following his graduation from the academy. Another sign of possible rebellion in 19th century Utah was short hair. As late as 1930, student columnist Sam Taylor observed that, quote, a young blood somewhat of a rounder and hellabout town has his hairline well above the ears in the rear. More conservative types lower it to the middle of the ears, and married men, mature members of society, earnest seekers after the light, and bankers have a scant half inch of smooth skin above the collar. As shorter hair and shaven faces became the norm, enthusiasm was still generated every year for a student beard-growing contest, which began in 1925 and continued every year for 40 years. The first intimation of official displeasure regarding long hair seems to have been when Ernest Wilkinson delivered his 1965 Welcome Back address, advising students that he did not want on campus any Beatles or Beatniks, and that there was no place at BYU for the grimy, sandaled, tight-fitted, ragged Levi look. Although Wilkinson did not explicitly refer to long hair or beards, students seemed to understand that these were implied by the blanket condemnation of popular styles, and joked that it would be a shame to see the campus rid of its statues, including the long-haired Brigham Young, the bearded Carl Mazur, and the American Indian Massasoit, with braids falling below his shoulders. In the spring of 1966, the campus newspaper noted an increase in the number of beards on campus. In fact, as late as 67, there were photographs of professors in the paper, for instance, with goatees and beards and so forth. That fall, Wilkinson recommended that students read the dress and grooming guidelines adopted by the church's Mutual Improvement Association, which stated that, quote, young men's hair should not be too long, end of quote. The guidelines also advise modesty in dress, but the issue of beards and hair length will provide an ample example of the broader controversy involving a number of dress and grooming issues for the purposes of this paper. In 1968, Wilkinson wrote to parents of incoming freshmen that while there can be no objection to a properly trimmed mustache, and there is surely nothing morally wrong about wearing a beard, we would prefer our young men to be clean-shaven and to keep their hair cut. However, the school's faculty dress standards committee reaffirmed the following spring that, quote, beards that are neat and well-trimmed are acceptable. Furthermore, the Board of Trustees cautioned Wilkinson not to suspend students based on beards or long hair, and Elder Delbert Stapley, chair of the Executive Committee of the Board of Trustees, specifically advised Wilkinson that, quote, a positive position should be taken, and instead of threatening students, administrators should appeal to their sense of modesty and decency, end of quote. Despite advice from both the Board of Trustees and the Faculty Committee, Wilkinson sent a letter to all students the next summer informing them that beards would henceforth be prohibited and that men's hair would no longer be allowed to touch their collars or ears. In January 1970, he wrote to the Dean of Students explaining that he had been, quote, trying to get a letter from the First Presidency, end quote, regarding beards and hair length. However, in its absence, he thought that the dean should issue a clarifying statement to the student body. The dean's press release was much less than the ringing denunciation of long hair Wilkinson had expected. The dean wrote that BYU had purposely avoided setting specific mathematical measurements for dress and grooming, and that no one was ever going to be expelled for dress standards. A memo from Wilkinson to the Dean of Students the following month agreed that students could not be dismissed from school solely on beards or long hair, but suggested that proper dress and grooming could be considered in determining the fate of students who were belligerent in other areas. Wilkinson told the dean that he had encountered two students who had long and shaggy hair and asked that the dean see how they were doing in school, find out their background, and also check with their bishop to see how they are doing there. It is unclear whether Wilkinson's concern in this area was based on the kind of image he wanted BYU students to present, or if he considered outward appearance to be a reliable indicator of deviant or subversive behavior in violation of the revised honor code. Whatever the case, Wilkinson warned students in an April 1971 address that they could be suspended without prior notice for what he called a combination of violations, including failure to cut their hair or shave. He said, I'm quoting from him now, "May I also say that we have found out through some careful checking we have been doing that those who violate dress standards are often those who are traffic violators, poor academic records. And finally, we find out that many of these who offend in these various particulars are those who fail, contrary to our regulations, to keep the university informed of their current addresses. From now on, all of these various items will be taken into consideration in judging whether a student should be suspended, and a combination of violations in these various areas will certainly justify immediate suspension." That summer, without having established a formal written dress and grooming code, Wilkinson was unexpectedly replaced as president by Dallin Oaks. And not until several years later would regulations regarding dress and grooming first appear in the school catalog, although the impetus given these issues by Wilkinson is, of course, undeniable. In Dallin Oaks' first address to students, he announced that he had no desire to make the razor and the tape measure symbols of his administration. Ironically, though, Oaks was the first BYU president to oversee the printing of a formal written dress and grooming code published in a pamphlet entitled A Style of Our Own. He did keep his promise, however, of downplaying the emphasis given to hair length and fashion. The standards adopted by Oaks reflected many of the traditions Wilkinson had tried to establish, such as prohibiting beards and requiring that men keep their hair short. But the rules were not as specific as the former president had hoped. Oaks came to BYU from the University of Chicago, where he had distinguished himself as a professor of law and as executive director of the American Bar Association. And his encouragement of intellectual pursuits and his desire for moderation in disciplinary measures were perhaps presaged by his involvement on the editorial board of Dialogue magazine and by his early membership as an undergraduate at BYU in the infamous Bricker fraternity, or social unit. Oaks eventually developed a conservative public stance regarding dress and grooming after the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare attempted to force the university to abandon its dress code on grounds that it was sexist. Oaks maintained that the difference in dress and grooming of men and women were proper expressions of God-given differences in the sexes, and vowed that the university would not be prescribed into a unisex standard of appearance. During this period, additions to the dress code included prohibitions against the no-bra look, shirts without sleeves, tank tops, and for men, going without socks. Under the most recent administration of BYU President Jeffrey Holland, who was raised in St. George and holds a PhD from Yale University, the regulation of student morals and fashions has continued its general conservative drift, but has remained more moderate than the early administrations of Brimhall or Wilkinson. The dress and grooming code has been expanded to preclude any color or style of hair that brings undue attention, which Holland quipped meant that anything that's in fashion we're against, and also to disallow earrings on men and safety pins in women's ears. To ensure conformity, a silent referral system was inaugurated shortly after Holland's arrival, involving often anonymous referrals to school officials regarding offenses of dress and grooming and moral behavior. Referrals are made by both university staff and by students, and students have been promised anonymity when calling in names of offenders. In 1983, students were told that they would thereafter also be required to submit to the school an annual verification by an ecclesiastical leader that they were still abiding by the university's moral prescriptions as indicated previously by their application for admission. During Wilkinson's administration, by comparison, local bishops were asked to report to school officials violations of school standards garnered from confidential confessions. These were actually sent out to bishops in the form of questionnaires, and they were actually returned to the university by the bishops. Some bishops. Alcohol and tobacco use, although minimal compared to indulgence in these substances in the first half of the century, also premarital sexual activity and devotion to ostentatious fashions continue, obviously, to be a concern to administrators at Brigham Young. In the related area of drug abuse, the chief of university police recently stated that after a decade of trying to prevent its infiltration at BYU, he was convinced that the school would never be rid of it. Regarding sexual behavior, President Holland recently stated that there is too much sexual transgression on campus. Any is too much, and we have much too much. In the area of dress and grooming, current fads have demonstrated the difficulty of trying to circumscribe fashion within a written static code. Still, BYU officials take some comfort in the fact that the student body is generally more sobrietous than, let's say, an average student body at any other large university, and that BYU students have become more conservative over time. Whether the extreme tactics in ensuring conformity to rules adopted by Presidents Brimhall and Wilkinson were more effective in assuring purity and uniformity than the laissez-faire approach of Presidents Clough and Harris is not clear. But it is evident that there has been a variety of opinion regarding the most effective and appropriate method for overseeing student behavior over the years. It is also clear that for a number of reasons, students conform more willingly to university rules governing their private lives today than they did during previous periods, particularly in such areas as those covered in this address, alcohol, sex, and dress and grooming. Thank you.
Since this is apparently a chapter of a book in progress, I hope that some of the discussion here today will be helpful to you in whatever you plan to do or have not yet done with this chapter. What I propose to do is analyze a few things briefly, essentially the thesis that has been presented, which includes an analysis of the predisposition of the presidents of the university, treatment of evidence, the conclusions made by this paper, and then I will present a few conclusions of my own. Outlining the development of the honor code at BYU is a task. It's a difficult one, and it's difficult also to attempt to suggest causes of such a development and to attempt to trace compliance to an honor code or to even see how that may correlate with how the behavior of students would correlate with an honor code or how the behavior of the students may reflect the mood of the students or other related factors as mentioned in the thesis. It seems to me the major difficulty of the paper as presented at this point is that its purpose is not clear. Its evidence is insufficient and inconclusive. The paper contains a great deal of very interesting material, but it's a bit shapeless right now. And since that's criticism always leveled at my own work, it's interesting to find myself leveling that at another person. I think the paper is less successful than it might be if it were written simply as a history. And part of the reason I think it's not simple history is the style in which it's written, and that will form part of the basis of my critique. I don't think that there's any point in trying to dispute the facts that have been presented or their organizational pattern on the whole. But we do have to ask their purpose. Why were these particular facts marshaled in the first place? And what is a reader or a hearer supposed to conclude? Here are the problems the paper presents for me. Let's go over the thesis sentence again. A common misconception about Brigham Young University is that it has always been a place of strictly supervised moral behavior, much like an Eastern military school. I'm not sure that that is a common misconception. I'm not sure what the common misconceptions about BYU are, and indeed that would form a topic of a different paper, wouldn't it? But it is hard for me to imagine anyone believing BYU to be so rigid or believing a military school to be so moral. This is an engaging opening, but I think it's a distraction. It suggests that we are misinformed and that the paper is going to provide us with information that will enlighten us, whereas I think most of what the paper does is tell us what we intuitively know to be true, that there's a variety of opinion and practices by people at BYU. When I discussed this particular point with a friend of mine about who would believe BYU so rigid, she said, "Must be someone from the U." But I'll discard that as another kind of bias. What happens in the structure of the paper essentially is to juxtapose certain elements in order to give us a certain impression about what was going on at the time. I'm not sure that we can divine an administrator's attitude toward an honor code or toward enforcement of an honor code on the basis of where he grew up and where he was educated. And yet this is done consistently throughout the paper. Let me remind you of a few of these interesting bits about the presidents. And they are interesting, but again, the point is, are they relevant to the discussion of the honor code? It seems to me that they're included primarily to indicate approval or disapproval of an administrative handling of situations. Here are some of the positive negative words used, for example. Of Mazur, the comment is that his teaching experience was limited to the 7 years in elementary schools, and yet that kind of background was not irregular for an academy during that time for an administrator. Note that he's said to be concerned for their moral safety. And the use of that phrase seems to me to imply a certain rigidity that may not necessarily have been there. Mazur was replaced. The word replaced is used rather than succeeded. That is, Brimhall is referred to as Clough's replacement, but Harris, who seems to have our approval, is termed as succeeding Brimhall. However, McDonald, who is considered less tolerant, is considered a successor. So simply the use of words such as succeed or replace may give us a feeling for an attitude toward an administrator, or it may suggest that to some readers, at least. MacDonald's lesser tolerance is followed by his vita, where he was educated, what kinds of jobs he had. Wilkinson's history, including his deprived boyhood and alleged crude mannerisms and penchant for off-color jokes, is injected in a discussion of changing sexual mores. Wilkinson was unexpectedly replaced as president by Dallin Oaks, another comment about Wilkinson that seems negative to me. And Oaks, who seems to be approved of, is shown as being linked with the University of Chicago, the American Bar Foundation, and is his involvement with the Bricker Social Unit and with the Editorial Board of Dialogue are claimed to presage his encouragement of intellectual pursuits and moderation in disciplinary measures. Holland's gentle humor and conservative drift is introduced very closely to the point that he grew up in St. George and he was educated at Yale. And I'm not sure where the humor came from or where the conservative drift came from. Presumably, juxtaposing these things is to give us an insight to the administrator's approach to indicate his predispositions. I'm not sure that this is relevant to the discussion. If it is relevant, then it seems to be it would also be necessary to try to catch what the student body was like. At what point did we stop having the student body composed primarily of LDS students from Utah and shift to a composition that may have been less homogeneous? And did that affect the moral behavior of students? And if so, how did it affect them? It's also unclear to me as to why some kinds of social information are included and other kinds are excluded. For example, in the discussion of Wilkinson's tenure, which seems to me to form a disproportionately large portion of the paper, the reader is not reminded that during his tenure there was a good deal of very serious violence on American college campuses, and that his tenure also coincided with what has been termed the sexual revolution. So that the political sexual revolution, as heralded by symbolic dress, symbolic sexual behavior, symbolic grooming, changes in grooming standards, were there at that time. We've finally gotten to the point where many of the readers of this book will be too young to remember that and may need to be reminded, so that Wilkinson might be viewed charitably as perhaps reactionary rather than simply mean-spirited. I'm not sure either that it is valid to try to attempt a comparison of attitudes about behavior among BYU students without comparing those attitudes to the changing mores of the society as a whole. And I think that that might be helpful material for this chapter to try to put in perspective whether the feelings and the behaviors of people at BYU were paralleling the society as a whole or whether it was diverging from the society as a whole. Of course, analysis of the mood of student bodies and their compliances to honor codes, especially in private behavior, non-public behavior, is difficult to do at all. And it seems to me that it is only weakly done here. If we were to try to judge social norms via editorials, letters to the editor, and articles in student newspapers, I think we'd have a very interesting view of society. Unless, of course, student journalists in the past were considerably more reliable and accurate than some are today. Also, I think it's important, too, that we realize, shall we say, the shock value that college students sometimes enjoy. The quotations about a Mennonite hall, for example, it's hard to know how seriously that was taken, whether it was a bit of fun. When my sister was attending BYU, I remember her sending a little jingle home at the end of one of her letters about BYU, BYU, where the girls are girls and the boys are too. And I don't think that was a serious commentary on student life. It was playful, and I don't think it was taken seriously by people at BYU, at least. Another question I have is why the particular aspects of moral behavior that are treated here were chosen. I realize that in a presentation like this, it has to be cut down to a certain size, But you can't help my wondering whether the issue of men's hair was chosen for some particular reason. I think many women who have attended the university would wonder why there was no discussion of wearing dresses versus wearing pants versus wearing Levi's. And I'm too polite to charge sexism. The real question is whether students and administrators have had more concern over things like sexual behavior than they have had over things like bouncing checks or non-payment of rent or other kinds of moral transgressions that could also affect a student's standing at the university. The next points deal with the use of evidence. Again, I'm not sure why we had such a long treatment of Wilkinson. It seems to me that at this point, I get the feeling that this is where the paper becomes interesting to the writer, that he's very interested in what happened in the Wilkinson era. It seems to me, too, that Wilkinson has become a very fashionable target, and that will appeal to a certain audience who will read the book, but it may also date the book or date the paper as having been written at this time and may detract from some of the other points that could be made. The studies that are presented, I appreciated the fact that there were a few more included verbally, make it difficult to know how to judge the evidence given or decide how much real documentation there is of some of these behaviors. And at best, those studies seem to indicate correlations, not causality. For example, the one that tries to show a longitudinal study of sexual behavior. Now, in the paper, the terms necking and petting were used, and I assume they were used in the original studies, and yet we're looking at a period of 30 or 40 years. In the slang dictionaries I checked, it seemed to indicate that those euphemisms, and euphemisms in general, are very vague. That's why they're euphemisms. So they tend to cover activity ranging from any expression of affection to sexual intercourse. And that it can be used even as early as 1910, meaning that, or as late as 1950. And, of course, as all good experts do, the experts disagree about how specific or how general the meanings are. So unless the studies correlated for the change in usage over this 30-year time period and tried to correct the study for regional variations, those particular terms may not be as useful as, say, the term sexual intercourse, which would be not euphemistic and would not, we hope not euphemistic, and would not cause a possible misunderstanding that the other words might. I sometimes found the footnoting less than helpful, and since you didn't have to deal with the footnoting, that isn't a concern with this paper, but in terms of publication of the book, it is difficult as a reader to know what it is you really want to chase down. And if you read a paragraph in which there is embedded one little bit that you say, where do you get that? And then you look at, there's one footnote at the end of the paragraph, and when you go back, then there's a half a page of footnotes, but they don't always indicate which footnote goes with which interesting bit of information. It's difficult to know how long you want to spend in the archives hunting it up. So it might be helpful to some readers who may want to pursue this topic further to make sure that the individual footnotes are a little more specific. On the basis of this paper, it would seem to me that there's not a lot of evidence about the behavior, though it is very possible to exemplify opinions about the honor code and about student behavior. It seems to me students have indeed been on their honor to obey or not obey the prevailing moral codes or predilections of administrations. It would be very helpful if there were any indication about how many students have actually had the moral code enforced, had to go to student courts, have received pardon me slips, or have been expelled from the university. This paper does not treat that. It may be that that information is not available. I don't know. Certainly, we all have anecdotal evidence about one thing or another that if I collect my friends together, I think I can find stories about so-and-so was hauled in to explain why he has a little braid 2 inches long hanging down from otherwise acceptable hair, or someone else may tell me the story about going through a shopping checkout line and having the BYU student in front of him use his BYU ID as identification to show that he's old enough to buy beer. So there are many anecdotal stories. It would be really helpful to try to document what the enforcement was. An analysis of the few conclusions, and of course this is not, these are sort of bits and pieces of analysis and not as well organized as we would hope, as I would hope. It seems to me that it's unwarranted to make some of the conclusions that are made in the paper. I'm not sure that we can conclude on the basis of this information that students today conform more willingly or that they are more conservative for a number of reasons, as the paper states. Some of those reasons that are mentioned in the thesis and the conclusion might be brought forward and identified and would help to build the case that I think must be being made, although, as I said, it seems to me that the purpose is not clearly stated for us. Let me give you an example of some of the language that seemed to me suggest certain kind of conclusions, even though they're not overtly made. Wilkinson and Brimhall are cited as having used extreme tactics in enforcing morality. And my reaction to the use of extreme tactics tends to make me think of treatment of gorillas, or it sounds very coercive, even physically coercive, and I'm not sure that that's accurate. Other readers may not feel that that is a loaded word. To me, that seems a bit loaded. Clough's and Harris's laissez-faire approach sound very nice, although it seems to me that essentially what we're measuring here is not enforcement at all, but it's the rhetoric used to talk about the honor code. That Clough and Harris tend to appeal to the high-mindedness of the students, whereas Wilkinson and Brimhall tended to delineate the crimes and the punishments. And the honor code ends up being criticized on both fronts for being too vague. So how do we know what it is you're going to catch us for, or for being too crudely drawn in outlining these specifics for which you may be called in. So I'm not sure that it's fair to handle it both ways. It seems to me that if you're taking both of those tacks, then what you're really trying to say is, wouldn't it be better if we'd all just be nice people and not have to worry about having someone in authority give us an honor code? Couldn't we just all be nice people without an honor code? One other thing that isn't mentioned that I thought would be helpful is whether or not instituting an honor code, which students had to read and sign, made any difference in student behavior or student attitudes about the honor code. And that seemed to me to be a glaring omission. Another bit of language on page 2. Under Clough's replacement, George Brimhall, the university returned to a policy of strict regimentation and administrative surveillance of morals. And yet, in the evidence given, this is an unwarranted conclusion, that previous thing, that was Mazur's administration, wasn't it? That's when we talked about boys sneaking out at night. So that, again, I think that's more evidence that there was tough talk, shall we say, but relatively little enforcement. So I don't think it's fair to make this kind of conclusion, because it seems to suggest a stronger case than the evidence can support. So again, my conclusion there would be that the evidence presented here would suggest that enforcement practices may not have differed, though the strength of public statements did. You might make an analogy to the spitting on the sidewalk laws. Many, many cities have laws about you can't spit on the sidewalk, but they're not enforced much. And someone could state that as in terms of simple etiquette, or they could state it as showing a lack of morality. They could make a strong statement or a weak statement, but probably neither would enforce it. For example, it seems that Holland's use of humor is approved. McDonald's threats of expulsion are not approved, and yet it would seem to me that the evidence doesn't show that Holland or McDonald would have enforced the honor code differently. Clough's call for high-mindedness and unspecified regulation seems to be approved, whereas Wilkinson's delineation of this is what you do wrong and this is where you go seems to meet with disapproval. My suggestions or conclusions. I'm a little concerned that this chapter might be interpreted as a vehicle for simply expressing approval or disapproval for a particular administrator, a particular administration. And as such, it would fall short of documenting what it says it will do, that is, documenting the use of alcohol, the sexual behavior of students, and the dress and grooming practices of students, and how they correlate with the honor code there. And, of course, this is a hard thing to do because it deals so much with behavior that is not public. The question for some readers may be whether this chapter would be intended to suggest that students, if left to themselves, would seek to be well-groomed and well-behaved. I don't know. I do believe in the basic goodness of humankind, but I also believe in the importance of reliable authority, and I believe in the importance of showing one's affiliation with various groups of society via the symbolic ways. Our dress, our grooming, shows us those people with whom we feel at home, we feel comfortable, we feel allegiance. And I also do believe that morality, including dress and grooming standards and bootlegging, is a valid concern of BYU. Thank you.